That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome back to That Money Show. I am That Money Guy, also known as Gabriel, and I am here every single week to discuss with you the latest trends going on in the economy, speaking to some incredible guests every single week. And in particular this week, we've got Harpreet Kaur coming up. She is the co-founder of Oh So Yum and winner of The Apprentice in 2022. And Emmanuel Asukwo, financial advisor and author and one of the best kind of voices in the personal finance content space. And like I mentioned early on, we're going to start off this show, as we do every single week, with a bit of an economy blitz, taking you through the latest stories of what's going on and keeping you up to date so that you don't have to constantly be reading the news and understanding it. And you're not just going to be listening to one voice. You've actually got two voices coming in. So I'm being joined by Thomas Kriaras, a financial advisor and someone that probably is much better educated on the topics we're about to discuss than I am. So firstly, thank you for joining. Welcome to the studio.
Hello. Thank you for having me on. It's great to see you.
Oh, you hit me with so much energy then. That was absolutely brilliant. But let's dive straight in. I've promised the listeners that we're going to talk the news. But what is going on right now? Well, the first story that I'm going to start quizzing you on is a little bit about house prices. I speak about house prices so much, like genuinely so much. And this is the latest figures coming out today. Good news. Well, good news, I suppose, if you're a house buyer, not if you are looking to sell property. But house prices are down 0.4% compared with last month. And to kind of contextualize that a little bit, the average price of a home now in the UK, £261,962, which is 4% lower than the peak that we saw last summer. So that's summer of 2022. A couple of other kind of key stats that are going up is that mortgage rates, they're going up a little bit. One lender looking to raise them as much as 0.2 percentage points. That's like if it's currently 4.5, it goes up to 4.7, just to contextualize that a little bit. But what do we think straight off the bat? I mean, house prices going down, ultimately good news because we're in such a hot economy, or do you not like it?
Oh, it's just reflective of the fact that we are going into a recession. I think if you ask most people, they wouldn't really know, because it's not really being reported on. No one's saying, yeah, we're in a third quarter of negative economic growth. I know that's kind of an oxymoron, but we're going to go with it. And it's just devastating because whilst it's good for buyers, no one has the money. The money just isn't there because the UK is officially in stagflation. And it's devastating for first-time buyers and also for house owners because, you know, for most people, when you own a house, that is your biggest asset. And when you see those numbers go down, it can be devastating, especially when you're approaching retirement.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose the reason why, like, I kind of look at it through rose-tinted glasses is because I'm looking to become a first-time, like, buyer. Like, that's kind of the stage of life that I'm up to. So when I see, like, prices are coming down 0.4%, I'm like, yeah, baby. Doesn't mean necessarily they're coming down in the area that I live or want to live in. But to me, that sounds good. I think that, like, it's so important, the point that you raised, which was that just because prices are coming down doesn't mean that anyone is any more able to afford that tiny little 0.4% drop. So it's kind of like we said, good news, bad news, really depends on your position. But overall, what is the feeling that you're getting out of, you know, the world you're in, the financial advisor world? What is that feeling around the housing market?
For young people, this is going to sound really sad, but it is a sense of dire hopelessness. People are delaying even thoughts of going into the property ladder, getting onto the property ladder. So there was a study that showed in 2000, the most common circumstance, I think it was 1990 actually, the most common circumstance for someone between 1990 and 2000 were at the age of 27 was with a child in their first bought home. And now is living at home, single.
Or moving back home.
Moving back home.
To parents' homes. And this is another really important one because I've seen more and more posts going out online or people even in my own circles that are moving back to their parents and feeling like failures because of it. You know, you're in your early 20s, you move out, you know, you've got that influx of cash all of a sudden from your first job. Then you realise that it's not just the rent you have to pay when you move out of home. It's the bills. Mm-hmm. It's the actual cost of living. You know, your mum and dad aren't filling up your fridge anymore. You don't have, you know, that free ride to wherever you need to go. All of a sudden, you're not splitting petrol costs with whoever you're sharing the car with. All of these other factors are coming into just moving out from home. It's not just the cost of, like, moving or the cost of rent. And so they're kind of like, well, I failed. If you move back home, you failed. And I feel like we need to start flipping the narrative in this country a little bit. I mean, like we said here, like, we're talking about the news story about 0.4%, this, that, etc. But the overall picture is it's never been harder to get onto the property ladder. Anything you can do to put yourself in an advantageous position, be that move home and save yourself X grand every single year, is genius, no?
It is genius. Look, household income increases with everyone working. So when you have, say, for example, you've got two parents living in the house, third person living in that house increases the household income, increases the purchasing power, and also divides the costs. We should be looking at it from perspective of, yes, let's work together as a family unit instead of empowering this Faustian spirit of, yes, 18, get out there, do your own thing, when really, no, you need to band together and work together, especially with family, because who else is going to help you other than blood?
Who else is going to help you apart from blood? So I'm going to ask one final question. Let's say you are someone, you've built up a bit of a deposit now, you know, you're looking at this house and market, it's coming down. When is the right time to buy? Because everyone's like, oh, but, you know, house price is going down, but now you're telling me that mortgage rates are slightly going up, but they were slightly going down last month. And so do I just wait this all out? Can we get back to the, you know, those times of 0.1% interest rates set by the Bank of England and less than 1% mortgage rates? I mean, the answer is probably time to forget about that. Yeah. But when is the right time?
I think there are two things to consider when it comes to buying a home. It's, is it too much house for what you're paying for? Because you don't want to realize, okay, this isn't just 30% of my income. It's not just 50, it's 70. It's pricing me out of even living. And then you have to get someone in. You don't want to think about that. You want to make sure the house is appropriate for you, even if it's just a single bedroom flat. And then the second thing is, how long are you going to stay in that property for? Because whilst you do look at it as an investment, it's not an investment. It's where you live. And sometimes that is worth more than the potential value it's going to be within the next 5 years. So if you can live somewhere for the next 5 to 7 years, 100%, don't worry about what the price is going to be. It's where you go home to lie your bed and no one can take it away from you, like when you're renting. That's one thing you do fear getting evicted. No one can evict you from your home unless you don't pay your payments.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. So let's say you have ticked all those you know, check boxes. You've got the affordability. It doesn't take up too much of your entire monthly salary. Mm. You found the right place that you're going to live in for a long time. And you're just thinking, oh, but maybe there's a better time. The truth is, if it's ticking all of those kind of everything, the green lights are going in a row, you know, you're ready to start your Formula One race. It's just time to do it. Because you never know what's happening tomorrow. You know, potential new government's coming in. We won't dive into that particularly, but no one knows what's coming. So the idea is, if it's right now, then, you know, take that jump. We like to discuss more than just one story because I only have you for a short amount of time today. And the second story that is very relevant going on right now is the idea, now listen to this, that across large parts of the UK, we would be £200 better off had wages grown at levels seen before the 2008 global financial crisis. So hear that, £200 better off. Now here's the absolute kicker and the crux of it, per week. So if wages had grown at the same rate pre the financial crash in 08, we'd be off £200 per week. For those of you that aren't great at maths, obviously I've written this down beforehand because I'm not that good at maths myself, that's £10,400 a year better off. I mean, how does that make you just feel?
That is absolutely madness. And not to get political, but you'd think under the Conservatives, which are the fiduciary party, you'd think that we wouldn't be in this situation, but it was obvious austerity didn't work and it's left people in this situation. And, you know, even when it comes to the stealth taxes, you know, we may have some of the lowest taxes when it comes to income in Europe, but our stealth taxes are some of the worst. You know, you've got the income tax freeze until 2028. That's actually a tax because as wages rise every year, you're getting taxed technically more. And it's just such a shame. And even with this national insurance cut, it's just a drop in the ocean when it comes to our costs that the government's impending on us.
Yeah, and I will come back to the national insurance cut because I think that's really relevant. But just to throw a bit more fuel on the fire, the stat is coming out that this is the most sustained period of wage stagnation since Napoleon times. That shows you the subjects that I didn't study in school, history and apparently English as well. So that kind of shows you the levels that we're at. And I don't think this even comes as a surprise to me. I mean, we know that wages over the past 2-3 years have nowhere near kept up with inflation. I mean, obviously, we were in a kind of this anomaly period of inflation hitting rates of over 11%, which was crazy at one point. And you're not going to go to your, you know, every single employer around the world is going to go, all right, 11%, yeah, let's go up with inflation, because that would just, you know, again, talking about fuel and fire, pour even more inflation into the economy and all that kind of stuff. But at some point, something has to change, right? This gap between, you know, the rise of our costs and, like we were saying before, the rise of house prices, which I feel like we're being priced out of living.
It's absolutely crazy. When you look at British Gas, when they reported their first half profits at the, in 2023, it was the first time it reached nearly $1 billion. And then you had supermarkets like Tesco, Asda, they had record level profits. And then when it comes to Thames Waters, what's going on there? We're seeing 40% increase in our water because it had been privatized and they hadn't been keeping up with the infrastructure investments, and the stakeholders don't want to pay for it now. So we literally have this situation where all our essential infrastructure, when it comes to food, energy, and even water, is all being pushed up. We're in a cost push inflationary period, and it doesn't seem to be ending anytime soon.
Now, I'm going to fight back because we've got to play devil's advocate and look at what's going on right now. If you speak to someone in the government right now and tell them these statistics, their response is going to be, you know, we're sticking to our plan right now. Inflation is back under control. I mean, was that them or was that just the way things were going to go anyway? We don't have to dive into that. And the one thing they're going to start highlighting more and more again is we cut national insurance. You know, the average worker is now £900 a year better off. Are we better off? And you mentioned before the idea of, you know, income tax cuts, freezing those until 2028, and that kind of moving more people into higher tax brackets, making us all pay more tax on our income tax. So even though we've had this cut, are we better off?
Even the stealth tax when it comes to the income, because there's a, what is it? There's a, where they freezed savings, the savings allowance. So even when you save money, if you make interest of anything over £1,000 a year, you get taxed on that. And that's been frozen as well. So all these things combined, it's just crazy how we're just suffering under this huge, enormous weight on all the shoulders when it comes to every piece of central infrastructure. This £900 savings a year in national insurance, it's a drop in the ocean. Yeah, that will help you a little bit, but not really. It's not really going to help us.
Yeah, it kind of feels like we all get distracted by the here and now, and we never kind of can expand what we're seeing over the past 10, 15, 20 years even, which is really scary. I mean, one stat that I want to share with you, and I was doing kind of a little bit of like, what are the numbers actually saying? So let's say we take the average salary in the UK, £35,000. The tax bill in 24, 25, after all the government changes right now, it is roughly national insurance and income tax, £6,280. Now, it does say for that exact same level that the tax bill, if they had kept national insurance at that 12% that it was, you know, prior to these cuts, but had kept income tax inflation related, it's actually higher, £6,646. So it kind of looks like it's helped the, you know, 30,000, 35,000 and above, but go below the average and it does the opposite.
Right.
You know, you're now paying more tax than you would have just having kept with the, you know, income tax bands going up with inflation. So obviously everyone's going to be in a different position. There's different earning rates, but it just doesn't feel like, if you look at the bigger picture, anything's been done. It just feels bad. And like we said, back to Napoleon times, eh? for us here?
It definitely does. It does feel like there's the economy is being dichotomized. It feels like the middle class is being pushed into working class. And unless you can push yourself through social mobility into a higher earnings bracket, especially working, you know, especially if you get into a couple, two household incomes, it increases your purchasing power. If you go, it's pushing people one of two ways. And there doesn't seem to be a government that is saying we need to save our middle class, because those are the ones who thrive, make the economy thrive, really, in the end. And that, but what can they do? I feel like, you know, the government can only play the cards they are dealt.
And just to reference off the back of that, the middle class, we keep thinking of like a certain specific income range. That income range, by the way, goes up with inflation.
100%.
So just because you might have assumed middle class was around, you know, that £30,000 or £20,000 range, nowadays it's going to £30,000, £40,000, £50,000. that's not the higher income anymore. No. That is the average, the middle class, especially when you're looking in kind of the southeastern regions and London, which holds the majority of the UK population. But yeah, just some food for thought. That was me and Thomas arguing back and forth about the state of this country.
We're arguing.
We're arguing over the exact same opinions. But yeah, that's a little bit on the news. Mm. I hope that you, the listener, feel a little bit more maybe refreshed and understanding of the situation going on, because all we can do is power you with the knowledge, and you can utilize that to actually implement the change that you want to see in your life and the changes that you want to see, you know, in your economy and with your policy. Thomas, is anything you kind of want to leave the listener with about the news and about the state of the economy right now? Maybe something positive?
Something positive. Look, whilst things are looking quite dear, I think the thing we can look about is there's a light at the end of the tunnel. Inflation is coming down, and hopefully in the next 2 to 3 years we can see things start to stabilize and then us finally thrive in the lovely Great Britain we live in. But I will say households that stick together thrive together.
Amen. Absolutely love that. Well, stick around, because we're going to start going on a more positive journey for the rest of the show. Because straight off this, I've got Harpreet Kaur, the co-founder of Oh So Yum, and really excitedly, the winner of The Apprentice in 2022, to talk all things business.
FUBAR Radio presents
What the Health with Gabby Allen.
Joining me now is Millie Gooch, author and founder of Sober Girl Sobriety Society. I need to know what is so bad about dating sober.
I think it's just terrifying when it's something that you're not used to, because when I was drinking and dating, you know, like, you use it to calm your nerves, you use it for confidence, you rely on it. And I think that's the one thing I realised when I stopped drinking, is how much I really relied on alcohol. I was always kind of saying, you know, like, oh, I'm not dependent on it, but for my confidence I was really. But I also think there's so many benefits to it, like I used to go on so many dates when I was drinking, I'd be like, they are the one, and then I'd meet them a few weeks later sober and I'd be like, we've got nothing in common, what was going through my mind? I'd be like, oh, it was because I was drunk.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
Harpreet, how are you, my love?
I'm great, thank you. How are you? It looks fun in there.
I want to talk about this, because obviously you met your partner on The Apprentice. When did you start to get that feeling, I'm into him, and this is more than just a banter or a friendship? Because it's a close environment being on a show like that, isn't it?
I really wish I could sit here and give loads of juicy gossip. Actually, we used to secretly meet in the laundry room on the show, but we didn't. And when I actually last spoke with yourselves, I think it was right after I'd won, we weren't even flirting, never mind dating. First time that I thought I actually fancied him was when I watched him on TV, and I watched episode one. Hang on. You know, he's actually really good looking.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani.
And joining me in the studio, we have Deputy Leader of the Green Party, Zach Polanski. Zach, thank you so much for joining us. How are you keeping, Zach?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. How are you?
So you're hoping for 4 MPs in the general. You think that's going to happen?
Yeah, that's absolutely the minimum at what we're
I don't want to be Piers Morgan here, but will you take out, I don't have £1,000, will you take a £100 bet with me that you'll get 4 MPs?
Well, I do everything in politics to talk about the harms of gambling. So for me to place a bet on there would be pretty,
you know,
pretty horrendous.
Before we had you on, we discussed with the producers as to whether I should do the bet joke. And I said I would, because I had every faith that you would answer it in the way I expect a politician of any moral standing.
We should also talk about
standing.
Cryptocurrency, which also is very problematic.
Rishi, if you're listening, mate, that's how you answer a betting question.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
So one other story that we haven't had the chance yet to cover today was that new research from NatWest has suggested that consumer confidence is bouncing back in the UK, with people predicting a brighter financial future for the first time in 2 years. Well, I mean, they've clearly done the survey. I'm not sure exactly how I'm feeling personally, but good thing you don't need to hear from me right now, because I'm being joined by Harpreet Kaur, the co-founder of Oh So Yum, and winner of The Apprentice in 2022. Harpreet, thank you so much for joining us today. How are you doing?
I'm great, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Absolute pleasure. I mean, the first question is to ask for your reaction off the back of that story that I just shared. So is this positive news from NatWest? And does it feel like the economy is turning around at this point? Maybe even specifically from your own perspective within your own business?
I think it's great news and definitely what I think we all need to hear, just as the general public. Does it feel like that right now? I'm not quite sure. I think there have been a lot of challenges that we've all had to face. I mean, I'm a small business owner, so I've definitely felt the effects of the rising costs. And it's just been one thing after another. You know, we've had Brexit, COVID, cost of living crisis. It's just seemed to have been never ending. And I think that has really passed on to all of us as consumers, and it impacted the disposable income we've got. So I think we need to hear this news, because it hopefully just shifts everyone's mindset a little bit, because maybe if we're not feeling it right now, maybe it gives us all a little bit of hope that there are things to look forward to, and as a general vibe that it might be moving in a better direction than it has been.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, the news has just felt like it's been a constant negative story after negative story. Cost of living crisis, inflation going up, interest rates going up, you know, mortgages, borrowing, all this kind of stuff. So like you said, even if it's just a few positive stories to psychologically start turning the nation around, it's absolutely vital. But I want to switch gears a little bit and ask you some more specific questions about yourself, because like you mentioned just then, you're a small business owner. What made you go and start a business in the first place? Did you have a background kind of in a more established, like normal career in quotation marks, or have you always been an entrepreneur?
Great question. And I'm going to have to cast my mind a little bit now, because it was almost 10 years ago that I set up my business. And I like that you brought this into the conversation, because actually the reason I set up my business initially was because I wanted to make more money. You know, you read up, you go into jobs, and you are told that actually there is a cap and a salary cap. And actually, if you want your future financial prospects to be limitless, then you've got to go self-employed. I was actually in banking before this, and I got to a good position. I was a retail branch manager for a couple of you know, very well-known retail banks. And I was quite young at the time. I was 22, 23, so the future was looking bright in terms of what I could earn, but I just had this entrepreneurial itch that actually I really want to work for myself, because maybe I can earn more money and allow myself to grow in a number of directions rather than having to follow a set path.
So how did that story end up actually looking and taking place? You said about 22, 23, when that itch really started to kick in and you made that decision to set up your own business. How did the journey evolve up until we get to the story around The Apprentice?
So definitely a roller coaster. You know, anyone listening that has set up a business or runs a business, I think when you initially get going, you really can underestimate the costs that are involved. Everything, you know, costs pretty much double than what you've anticipated and budgeted for. So it can be really difficult to get over those initial challenges and blocks. And that's why such a large proportion of businesses do fail within the first 18 months. And it's really kind of disheartening to see, because actually there are lots of great ideas there and great business people behind those ideas. But unfortunately, the costs can become too much and can overcome, you know, the prospects of the business. So luckily for us, you know, we held tight. We managed to make it work. We focused on where we wanted to grow, focused on a vision. And I'd say, you know, years two to kind of six were great. You know, we managed to employ staff. We were making a healthy profit, doing really well, and got it to a really good business model where I then did go on to The Apprentice. And, you know, proved that my business model worked that well that Lord Sugar decided to invest in it, which was fantastic. Past couple of years, I would say the landscape has really changed. And actually, firstly, with the investment, it's great because it's given us an opportunity and a platform to branch out into different areas and look at other income strategies. But on the other front as well, we just like every other business, have been really hit by these extra costs. You know, for example, electricity to run one of my dessert shops, it's over double what it used to be. The product, the packaging, the ingredients, you know, has gone up by at least 30% over every line. So you are now forced to think of different income strategies to keep your business afloat.
Absolutely. And I suppose to kind of help the listeners who have been hearing me talk about, you know, inflation story after inflation story, this is why you see the actual price of the things that you end up purchasing going up, because the businesses like yours have had their own costs going up and they still need to be profitable. They need to, in a way, pass that on to the consumer. Not always fully. Some do different rates and different amounts. But that's kind of, like we said, it's a domino effect. One cost goes up, so they pass on to the next, they pass on to the next, they pass on to the next, and eventually it ends up with you, the consumer, and that's kind of where inflation comes from. I want to touch now upon the apprentice part of your journey, because I think that interests me the most. You were running a successful business, it was doing well. Obviously, you'd been probably hit by COVID, because this was in 2022, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. What made you take that leap and go, do you know what? The apprentice is the right place for me at this stage of my career.
Do you know what? Being truthful, I think I got bored. So the company, me and my sister founded it. We'd been running it for a few years. And it was all going really well. Everything steady. We were looking at opening a third store under our dessert brand. COVID hit. And I saw the application for The Apprentice. And it was almost like a bit of a personal desire and challenge for me. I've always watched the show growing up and always wanted to do those tasks. When you're in business, there is no one to kind of gauge your skills against. Okay. So if you're in a workplace, you know, you've got a manager who can give you feedback and you can pitch yourself for a promotion so you know you're progressing well. Whereas when you're in business, there's no one to kind of bounce back off or, you know that you're a good business person, because there's no way to gauge it. So for me, it was almost like a personal challenge of, hey, can I do that too? Because you see people on social media and you do compare yourself and think, oh, you know, I'd love to be in that position and bag an investment, because if someone believes in me and believes in my business model, that's great. We can take it to the next level. So I'd say for me, it was really a personal challenge that led up to the decision-making process.
And it was a personal challenge that you passed with flying colours. I mean, you didn't just take part, you won the entire bloody thing. So I suppose that ticked that element of doubt in your mind off of it. How has that...
I did all right.
You did all right. I suppose you quite literally can't do any better. But how's that helped? How has that launched, I suppose, maybe not your business specifically, but your own personal brand? Because I suppose that's one of the biggest elements that come off the back of The Apprentice.
Oh, massively. I mean, first of all, regardless of my brand, it's just helped me as a person grow in so much confidence, because, you know, often we hear that to learn and to grow, you've got to throw yourself into the deep end. And that's exactly what I did. You know, as a viewer on TV, there's a lot that you don't see or maybe understand about The Apprentice. You know, these are genuinely just 16 to 18 normal people trying their best. And It's really not easy. The tasks are designed in a way to really test you under a lot of pressure. You know, you've got 10 cameras on you, waking up at 4 a.m. and you've got Lord Sugar staring you down from the other side of a table. It's a lot of pressure. So for me, it was actually just really a confidence building activity that actually you can handle pressure and you can handle yourself, not just with a team of staff that I do outside of The Apprentice, but with like-minded individuals that also have strong personalities. So it's kind of made me learn a lot about myself, and I wouldn't have learned that without throwing myself into the deep end. And secondly, you know, what I didn't actually anticipate coming out of The Apprentice or applying for it is that I, as a person, will be given a platform as well as my business. You know, I've got a huge community behind me, ranging from women that like the fact that I'm confident and put myself out there. I was also the first British Asian winner, which for a lot of people means a lot, because you don't see as many brown faces on TV. So I was almost representing a community in a way, and I got that automatic support. And it's been great. You know, I've got my own radio show now on BBC Asian Network, and I shouldn't be promoting that on here, should I?
You've said it now.
Listen to FUBAR. But I've been able to get additional opportunities that allow me to have a voice and hopefully inspire and help others as well in business, because there's room in business for everybody. I get a lot of questions and emails from other bakers and people wanting to start food businesses. And for me, there's room for absolutely everyone in business, and it's tough enough. So it's nice for me to be able to help and support others.
So, I mean, it sounds incredible. And you've got to this stage now, like you said, the brand is brilliant. You ticked off that kind of personal mission. The business is going well. I want to ask one final question, because this is a money show. It is that money show. And given all of your experiences over these years, what is one piece of specifically financial advice that you wish you had known 5 years ago, 10 years ago, that someone else can take today and start implementing?
That's a great question. You know, when you're growing up and your parents always tell you to put money to the side for a rainy day?
I remember.
It's true. Those rainy days will come and happen. And it might be due to no fault or factor of your own business model, because, you know, you might be excessively profitable. It might all be working perfectly. You know, I have a very physical business. So we have products, we have stores, we have staff. So things like maintenance issues will crop up, and that's normal, and you can budget for that. But nowadays, in the climate and landscape that we live in, there can be those rainy days that you never anticipated, such as, you know, business rates going up or a new tax that the government has decided to impose that you never ever really factored into your business model. So I would say, when you're looking at your finances, you have to think of every element of cost. Don't just look at the gross profit. Look at all your overheads. Look at things like VAT. Plan ahead 12 months in advance for your corporation tax. And make sure that we would all love to chase our passions. And I feel like, you know, many, many years ago, business was a little bit easier. You set up a business, it makes some profit, you have a good margin, and it's great. Nowadays, there are a lot of factors that come into it. So we can't just chase our passions. You really have to put financials there as a huge factor. And in early days, I was just happy to run a business and loved that people liked my desserts. Whereas over time, you realize that actually you have to make sure that it's viable enough to the point where it's worth putting that extra effort in.
That is a brilliant piece of advice. The saving for any day, expect the unexpected. I think it is really vital, especially taking something as risky as starting your own business. And also particularly being from the UK, where it feels like it never stops raining. So saving for a rainy day is like saving for every single day of the year. Thank you so much, Harpreet. It has been absolutely invaluable, the advice, the stories you have shared. So we appreciate you coming on today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
All right. Wishing you all the best. And that now brings us to what we like to call money tip of the week. If you remember, cast your mind back to the news stories we were discussing earlier, talking about the effective cost of living and the effect that national insurance and the changes that we've had over the past few months, especially here in the UK's economy. One thing that I want to share with you is this idea of lifestyle inflation and how it links to the latest national insurance cuts. So, one thing that we often do is when we get more money, we spend more money. Now, national insurance, for most people, has meant that we now have a little bit more money being put back into our pocket every single week that perhaps you didn't expect to happen about 4 or 5 months ago. And this is just something that I want to ask you to do, if you can, as a bit of advice. If you can just ignore the fact that that is extra money and put it straight into savings, you were doing fine without it 4 months ago or 5 months ago, if that is the case. So nowadays, why do you need that? Why do you need to spend that extra income? Put it away, put it towards, you know, like we said, that rainy day saving, put it towards that long-term investment, because this should be like extra free money towards your future, not towards your current shopping habits. Obviously, asterisk in there for those that were struggling beforehand, and this has become as a huge break for them to be able to, you know, afford their current lifestyle. But don't use that money to inflate your lifestyle. And that brings us to the end of this little segment. And coming up after the short break, I'm going to be joined by Emmanuel Asuko, financial advisor and author.
Hey!
FUBAR Radio presents
Access All Areas.
Mark from Married at First Sight UK.
See, at the wedding, you told Sean you were 26, but you're actually 36.
Yeah.
So drop in that decade. We ain't gone 1 or 2 years either side. What was going through your head when you pushed out, I'm going to shave off 10 years.
A 26. Third of your life.
Yeah.
It was instant reaction. As soon as anyone says to me, how old are you? I'm like 26. I just stopped counting after 26. Would I have told him? Probably not.
No. Ever?
Well, maybe when we're 80 years old and we've got the grandkids running around. And
except
like,
you wouldn't be 80 years old. No. You'd be 98. Yeah,
I'd be 26 still. I'd be going around the corner for some more injections.
Politics Uncensored.
Joining me now, the former leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, MP. And there you are stood with hundreds of thousands of people at Glastonbury singing, "Oh, Jeremy Corbyn." What is that like?
It was quite extraordinary. It was an amazing experience, and I was very pleased we did it. We wrote, the office got very excited about Glastonbury. Every single person in the office thought it was necessary for them to be at Glastonbury.
Yeah, I'm sure they did. Yeah.
Every single one said it was really necessary for them to come.
The Dating Show. I'm friends with a fair few exes, and I think you can be friends with an ex, but yeah, I genuinely do. But I do think that his timing is everything with that.
I think it depends what you cast as a friend.
Yeah,
are you talking about you know, someone you're going to hang out with on your sofa? Like, if you've already shagged, you know, isn't that a bit weird? Or is
no,
it
I think that's a different level of friend. I think that's a different level of friend. You can be friends with someone. You can't be, like, best fucking friends with someone. I mean, I've got exes that I talk to about their current partners and whatever else, and they'll tell me about that sort of stuff. But I wouldn't say, oh, do you want to come over for fucking Chinese and chill on the sofa?
You're listening to Fubar Radio.
Fubar Radio.
Hello and welcome back to That Money Show. I am joined by another incredible guest, Emmanuel Asukwo, financial advisor and author. You might know him as the E-Man Effect, and he is here in the studio joining us now. Now, I'm going to go straight in with a question that I want to ask. It's about your book.
Go ahead.
It's called Get Your Money Right.
Yes.
What's that about? What does that even mean?
Yeah, you know what it was is I wanted to write this book. Number one, hi everyone. Hey Gabriel, lovely to lovely
manners.
To,
I like lovely it. To be polite. Here. Sometimes I forget mine right
no,
there.
No, you're all right. You're
it's
good.
Nice to have you.
No, it's wonderful to be here with you in person. I love that. Get Your Money Right. I think the big thing for me was a lot of the books that I was reading were American, you know, and a lot of the times I was get DMs, but Emmanuel, I've read this online about this mutual fund that I can, and I'm like, I know you've read an American book because you're calling it a mutual fund, number one. And like, how do I get you to understand how it works here in the UK? But also, how do I get you to understand that the job is not done when you work for your money? Like, so for a lot of us, we work for money, but we haven't learned to make money work for us. Mm. And so what I wanted to do is teach you in the book is actually, how does money work? What are the principles of money? And then how do you start to make it work for you so that it's actually working right?
And what does that mean? Because everyone hears this like line, make your money work for you.
Yeah.
Like, what does that, like, I put my money away. What does it mean work for me? Do I need to buy things with it to, like, make it double? But then is that gambling? Like, what's going on there?
I love how you ask this question like you don't know the answer. Because I watch your content. I know you do.
Well, do you know what?
I
want to ask it from the perspective of the listener. Because if I didn't know, that's how I would ask it. I'd just be confused by that line.
No, I love it. But, because you asked it, I was like, oh, it sounds like you... No, but and then I'm like, no, this Gabriel knows more than me. Don't ever, like... So, yeah, anyway, the good thing for me, I think, what it is about is when you're thinking about how do you make money work for you, let me give you an example. So you got a debit card and you pay for something and you use your debit card and you pay for it and it's done. You get a credit card with rewards, you pay for the exact same thing and then you use your debit card to pay off your credit card. Now you've made money work for you because the same money that you would use to buy something that would have got you nothing now gets you rewards, number one. So that's an example. Number two, and a great example, you know, savings account. So like you said, we all know to save. But as we've all learned, inflation's not a myth. It really does exist.
Oh, it happens.
And we've seen the effects of it. So actually, how much do I actually need to have in savings? So my emergency fund. And then everything else, I need to be looking to try and get that to be working for me. Whether that's in an investment, whether that's in property, whether that's in a business or a side hustle, I need to be making it work. Because if I've gone hard to work for my money, why am I leaving it? I always tell people, banks don't use bank accounts. Yeah, so when you see a bank and you see all these buildings, all these head offices, most of those floors are them trading our money. So if a bank has our money and they're trading it or they're trying to make it work and that's their main business, that's how they really make money. They either lend it out or they trade it. Then I need to know is either I'm going to lend it out to friends at interest rate or invest it in something at interest rate, or I'm going to have to start making it work for me.
I like what you said there and I love that fact about banks. It's so important for us to realize that you're giving that money to your bank. It's not sitting there like in a vault being protected. They are working that money hard. Like, even like the simple idea that they will, you know, borrow your money and pay you a certain interest rate, but they're going to lend it out and charge a higher interest rate.
Exactly.
Simple maths, right?
Yeah.
Back and forth.
And I tell people, why don't you do that? Well, you in your small world, you could be a bank. You might have £5,000 and you might know someone that has a business and they need a £3,000 loan. You can make an agreement and say, I'm going to lend this money to you over this period of time. I want X amount back over that time. Do you agree? Get a contract. Now you're a bank. We can use the stuff. We don't have to, you know, have a sign and have a branch before we can do this stuff. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I can agree more. Obviously, they take the risks on, and as with everything, there's risk, etc. We like to generalize here, but it's an important mindset shift.
Exactly.
We're not telling you to go out and do that like tomorrow.
Tomorrow, please.
Please start a bank in your local high street. Just hand out cash to whoever asks for it and charge them crazy interest. Obviously, that's not what we're saying. It's just this idea of switching your mindset and understanding the opportunities that are available.
Sure.
So I learned recently that you were raised on a council estate in London.
Yeah.
Did that mold your own personal finance habits, even the ones that you're keeping to today?
Good question. I think there are some things that I've kept, do you know what I mean? But also there are some problems from that. So like growing up in poverty, growing up not having a lot, you grow up with a mindset, what we call a poverty mindset or scarcity mindset, where you feel like there's not enough. Mm. So even when you make money, you feel like, oh, I can't spend it, I need to save it, or I can't do this, or I can't live, or no was a word that you heard a lot of. And so, again, sometimes you might feel like it's going to be a no, so I'm not going to try. So, again, there are certain things being in those environments. Also, you know, being in those environments, you grow up seeing people who maybe do things that are not legal, but they tend to have really nice stuff. Because one of the things we see is that if you don't have much money, you search for things that make people think you do have. So if I know that I see all the time of my clients as a financial advisor, my really wealthy clients, if you saw how they dress, you'd probably give them a fiver if they sat down on the side of the road, because they know they've got money. They can go into their online banking. They have nothing to prove. So they dress how they feel comfortable, and they're comfortable to move how they are. Whereas people who tend to feel like, actually, I don't have that much, will now feel like I need to have that belt or that watch, or I need to be in first class or go on this holiday or show people. And actually, it's a lie. Do you know what I mean? And so that's one of the things I think growing up in poverty really causes you to do.
Yeah. I mean, there's a really kind of large line that is sticking in my head right now, and it's this idea that you don't become a millionaire by spending £1 million. You become a millionaire by having £1 million, and it's such an equal one. I mean, you talk about rich people not having to show off. I mean, think about quite literally the richest people in the world, your Jeff Bezoses, your Mark Zuckerbergs. Look up a picture of them from today, yesterday, whatever the most recent picture, and try and figure out what brand of t-shirt they're wearing. I guarantee you it's probably like H&M or something like that, because they know it's like there's not the necessity. And another thing that's like really important to understand is these luxury brands that are marketing to you to try and get you to wear their logo on their shirt. You know, they are advertising to the middle class.
Yeah.
They don't go for a lot of the times the upper class. Obviously, the upper class will sometimes purchase them. That's irrelevant. It's this idea that their marketing effects go towards you, because they know that if you can show you're wealthy, you think you're wealthy, but it's one of the most dangerous and damaging things about personal finance.
Yeah, and so for me, I one of the biggest lessons people always ask me, what's one of the number one lessons you always teach your clients? One of the first things I teach my clients is you got to love yourself. You got to understand that you are already valuable. You're unique. Anyone, we're all one of a kind. So if you're one of a kind, you're already unique and valuable. So therefore, your value doesn't increase by the car that you drive or the clothes that you wear. You're already valuable. And when you understand that concept, you make better financial decisions.
You ever heard that line, which is also like, if you're driving down a road in a nice car, no one looks through the window and goes, ah, that guy. They look at the car and they go, ah, that car. They couldn't care less who's inside of it. I mean, unless you're like Lionel Messi driving that car, then they're obviously going to be interested in who you are. Yeah. But if you're like, whatever, where you got this car to impress other people, people like the car. They couldn't give a crap who's inside that car door. I want to ask you something back to your book again, because you made things sound really easy in a way. And obviously the classical thought process with money is that it's complicated, it's hard, there's a lot of jargon involved, like terms, interest rates, APR. Like, is it overcomplicated at the moment, this financial system that we live in?
Yeah, I think it definitely can be. You know, I was having a conversation the other day about
how do we get people with some other financial influence? How do we get people, you know, understanding and get them start investing? And it's like, they were like, oh, you know, people need to know like pound cost averaging or dollar cost averaging. And I'm like, you do not need to know that to get, you don't even need to know any of that. Like, I just use this analogy. Like, if you, in London, you buy a coffee and a croissant, it's like £10. Do you know what I mean? You buy five of those in a month, that's £50. Like, other than the coffee and croissant, there's no return. You get, you know your money's gone. So you, that same analogy, like, if you now put that same £50 into the S&P 500, and that's just the top 500 US companies, I'm not saying you're going to get a huge return. It might even go down. But there's a potential that you could make money. And as long as you understand that I'm putting this in and there's a potential gain that I could get over time, you'll weather the ups and downs and you'll learn as you go along. Rather than saying, I need to know every single financial term and abbreviation and all of this stuff before I get started. You don't need to know that. You just need to know, I need to start doing something with my money, where's something safe that I can do, get started, and then I can learn as I go along.
Classic, like, psychology is, like, you try and put things off by saying, like, I'll start when I know enough.
Yeah.
You'll never know enough. To me, the only reason I ever started investing was because someone told me, use this account. I was like, but I don't know about investing. Like, just do this, put it in.
Yeah.
The moment my money went into an investment account,
yeah,
I was like, now I need to learn. Yes. Now I need to understand. But I was already an investor at that point. I'd done the action first, and it inspired me to then work hard. And as I learned, I did more investing or more saving or knew kind of where to put my money. And I think that's vital. Without skin in the game, there'll always be an excuse. It will always be tomorrow, not today. What was it? Nike, just do it.
exactly that. And I think with my book, one of the biggest complaints I get is that it's too easy. And I'm like, that's fine. If my book is too easy for you, that's fine. It wasn't for you. And it's really important in life to understand that you can't please everybody. Do you know what I mean? Like, know who you're doing it for. But I know when I go out and I meet people who have never invested before, never thought they could, they now have the confidence to do so. And I feel like that's what I did it for. And again, there are loads of other books out there that can be more complicated once you've understood the basics. But until you understand the basics, everything else just feels so far away.
We were talking just before we came into this studio about the change in name of your business.
Yes.
Because your name's Emmanuel, but there's something called the E-Man Effect.
Yes.
What's the E-Man Effect?
Yes. So the E-Man Effect is basically something that my actual followers kept saying to me, and so I changed my company name to it. And basically what the E-Man Effect is I had followers who would go out and they're about to shop, they're about to buy something, and they would hear my voice or they'd play one of my videos in their head, and then they'd put the item back and walk out.
Don't do it.
Exactly.
Don't do it.
Exactly that. And then they would message me. Like, I'd get these messages in the DMs, and they'd be like, I was going to buy this, but I didn't buy it. That's the E-Man Effect. And I heard it like 6-7 times, and I was like, you know what? Different people saying it, I'm going to change my company name to it, and that's the E-Man Effect.
Do you want to know? I've got a very similar story, because my name online is That Money Guy.
Yeah.
And it's like, people used to come up to me and be like, hey, are you like That Money Guy on TikTok or Instagram? And I was like, you're like, yeah, I've got a name, it's Gabriel, but that's cool. You remember, like, you know, you're That Money Guy. I was like, I suppose that's my name now. Same as you hear something enough. So the E-Man Effect is this idea about helping people make better financial decisions.
Yes.
Whether subconsciously you're activating into their memories,
yes,
or through social media and other platforms. But previously you were a financial advisor.
Yeah.
What made you want to take that switch from, you know, a corporate career into an educator?
Yeah, you know what it is that as a financial advisor, I had a dream to be a financial advisor. I wanted to do it, and I did it, and I got there. And then I realized I was just helping rich people get richer. And like, if you understand what it's like to, I started being a financial advisor at 22. So I was on I was still living at my mum's house on a council estate, but then I used to go and work in the city. And so I go to work, and my day-to-day clients and people that I would meet would be wealthy and, you know, all of this. And then I'd come home and it's like, these people can't put £2 together. Do you know what I mean? Everyone's struggling to keep the lights on. And I just said to myself, how do I become the difference? Because I'm living in this parallel universe. And so I really wanted to become the difference. And I realized that there's this, in the UK, they won't say it's class, but what they'll say is that, oh, you need to have at least 50K or 100K to become a client. And I'm like, how does someone get to 50K or 100K if no one's ever taught them how to manage £100? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so then I was like, how do I speak to them? But with the regulations being the way they were, I was like, I just have to step away and just educate people. And then now, the reason I've gone back to financial advice is that actually I've educated for so long, because we've been doing this for like 7 years now, that the effects mean that I actually get people who have listened to it and they're like, oh, I've got money now, I can invest, can you help me? And so now that's why I come back to it. But yeah, it was really about getting people from that place to get them ready to be, you know, be a, use financial advice.
The E-man effect, am I right?
Yeah, no, definitely, that's it.
But it's a really important thing you said, because that first 50K, that first 100K yeah. to set the real effects of compounding
yeah.
are by far the hardest.
Exactly.
Like to get that first sum, it's the hard work, it's the saving intensely, it's really living within your means. And then you can start to like take the fruits of the compound effects and, you know, the benefits that come from having large money, access to financial advisors yes. that set limits on what you're going above. So I like that distinction between helping people get there, but then they need more help from then on, right?
Exactly.
It's not like it ends there. I want to ask you one last question, which I like to ask most guests on this show. And that's just one thing practically that anyone listening can start doing today or be aware of today that can 10x their financial journey.
I think the biggest thing that I always tell my clients is that there's 365 days in a year. Why only get paid on 12 of them? And it's like when you realize that actually you can find a way to get paid every single day if you wanted to. There are so many different ways with technology. You know, there are so many different ways. If you've got skills, if you've got talents, if you've got passions, there are so many things that you can monetize. Don't just think about, oh, because, you know, save this and save that. Actually, if I want to go out, I can go out, but I just need to make some more money. Like, actually, the life I want to live, I can live. I just need to find ways to increase my income to live the life that I want to live. I don't have to just scrimp and save and cut everything back, because sometimes it feels like the reason people don't like what we do is because it seems like we're always telling people to stop living and stop enjoying life. But that's not actually what we're trying to do. There's the balance of, yes, you need to budget and save and be good with your money. But actually, if you want to enjoy your life, you can. Just make more money to do it.
I love it. Remember, savings are limited by how much you have.
Yeah.
Earnings are quite literally unlimited.
Yeah.
You can earn as much as, in theory, you want. Brilliant piece of advice. Hopefully people can take that on board. Emmanuel, thank you so much for joining us in the studio. Incredible advice.
Thanks for having me, Gabriel. And keep up the great work, man.
Thank you very much. And that now brings us on to the next segment of today's show. We are doing Scam of the Week. That is where I take a look at something that is not necessarily a scam that you find online, but just something that I'm not so happy with within the financial world. And the bones that I've got to pick today are with a little case study. I'm going to call them out. No offense. They are a great company, but Ryanair. Why do I have bones with Ryanair in particular? Well, I was trying to book a flight the other day, and I kind of looked at the price, was going through to checkout. My internet went down. I was like, it's fine. I'll go back through the booking system and I'll start again. Went through it again. This was literally 30 seconds later. The price had gone up by £20. I was like, that's got to be a glitch. Refresh screen, start again. It gone up by £50. And I was just thinking to myself, what is going on right now? Like, absolutely fuming. Like, how can this be happening? We're literally talking over a period of 10 minutes. Surely I'm the only person booking this flight in 3 months to Bulgaria. Anyway, that's the bones I have to pick. But what can be done about it? Well, there are so many things you can do to try and keep flight prices down, because at the end of the day, they're just algorithms. They see demand and they up the price. That's all there is to it. Number one, use flight comparison sites. There are so many. You don't have to just go with one provider. There are several out there. Number two, you can use things called VPN. So they don't know where you're processing your internet from. So they don't know it's you looking at and monitoring a flight again and again and again. And number three is, you can be flexible with your travel dates. So for me, it was very specific. But if you're flexible with your travel dates, obviously things are going to be going down. You can, you know, fly out on a random day, move it backwards a day, and all of a sudden your flights are like £100 cheaper. So that's just a little bit of advice. No offense, Ryanair. I still fly them. I've got nothing against them. This was just happened to be the case study. I picked on them this time. Who knows? It might be EasyJet. I might be coming for you by tomorrow. We also, at the end of every single show, like to answer some questions that come in from our guests every single week. And the reason why we like to do this is because ultimately people are embarrassed to ask questions about their money. And what we're trying to do here is remove the embarrassment. So if you are someone that has a question and wants it to be answered in next week's show or the week after that, all you have to do is go onto Instagram, find @thatmoneyshow or any social media @thatmoneyshow, send a DM with a question, and we will include it in the weeks coming up. Now, we've got the first question here from John, who is asking about going in for a raise and any tips for being in the best position to basically boost his promotion as high as possible. I do actually have a few pieces of advice, and this is firstly something that's really important. Number one is, When it comes to negotiating salary, remember it's a negotiation. When you're going in for a raise and you get offered something 3%, you're like, oh, I'm so happy with 3%. That doesn't mean that necessarily that's what you have to take. Remember, they're giving you an offer and it's for you to kind of understand your value and your net worth. So there are a few things, according to kind of research, that are going to help you with this position. Number one is obviously go in and take into account everything you've been doing. If you've got a job description, have you been going above and beyond? Just a lot of proof points as to the kind of why you actually deserve that raise. Or if you have hit your job description, prove with numbers and quantities what you've been doing and how you've kind of done that. But number two is look at what's going on in the market. Look at your position. Look at other companies that are, and other similarities in your area, in your environment, at your experience level, and understand what the range of salaries are. Because if you're even below the range, you have that automatic kind of power to put yourself in a much stronger position. You're coming in again with data and analytics. People can argue with reason and emotion, but they can't argue with hard facts and data. So the more of that you can back yourself up with, the better. And number two is, I mean, it's a classic rule of negotiation, right? Never take the first offer. They take an offer and you come back with them and say, listen, according to X, Y, and Z, this is my data. This is what I think it's worth to me. So that's kind of the first step when it comes to kind of salary increase. And actually something off the back of that is really important, because getting just a 1% extra boost in your salary every single time you go in for a raise. So let's say instead of 3%, it's 4%. And the next time again, instead of 3%, it's 4%. The compounding effect over your entire career can end up being hundreds of thousands, sometimes millions of pounds. Especially if you're in a high earning career, the effect of an extra percent, I don't think people sometimes realize, because remember, that effect just gets knocked on and on and on. So that's the kind of thing that I want to give you advice with. Good luck for obviously going in with that chat. I'm sure you'll be absolutely fine. And the next question here is from Steve, and Steve is asking about lifetime ISAs. He says, I live in London. I think that I'm going to be buying a property over the £450,000 lifetime ISA allowance. Does that mean I should still be investing into my lifetime ISA? This is a really important one. So lifetime ISAs, for those of you who don't know, are tools that help you save towards first-time properties, but only price up to £450,000. And what they do is you can save up to £4,000 a year, and the government will automatically add an extra 25% on top. So that's a maximum of an extra £1,000 being given to you by the government. But like I said, the caveat is that you can only use it on a property up to £450,000. So this is just a warning. If you're certain right now that that property is never going to be below 450, there's no point adding money to your lifetime ISA, because you get penalized. So as you put 20, get that 25% bonus, you also get 25% taken off. And just because of the way maths work, 25 is added on and then removed. Isn't that like you're going to get the 1,000 put on top of £4,000, and then the 1,000 just disappears. So you're back to where you were in the first place. It actually adds a penalty, because 25% of £5,000 is actually £1,250. So you went from 4,000 to 5,000. You want to not use it anymore. To withdraw it, you go from 5,000 to £3,750. I think that's about right. Sorry if my maths is off, but either way, there is a small penalty. And that's really important to be aware of. So if you're on the edge and you're not sure whether or not you're going to be buying £450,000, then maybe just hold it as it is. Don't withdraw it yet. Just wait until you actually make that decision. And maybe it'll be worth finding a property that's a little bit cheaper so that you can utilize it. But if you're 100% certain, especially if you're living in places like London, where £450,000 on a property is becoming less and less realistic, maybe it's time to ignore these products until they actually become relevant to your market again. Well, that now brings us to the end of this week's show, and what a show it's been. I want to firstly say thank you to our two incredible guests. We had Harpreet on, winner of The Apprentice. Pretty impressive stuff. Thomas on earlier, making sure that it wasn't just my voice drowning into your ears negatively about the economy. There are other people who are negative about it as well, which is great for me to hear. And also Emmanuel Sutko, just full of knowledge on the topic of finance. I would highly recommend going and checking all of them out individually. Such incredible voices and such incredible ranges of knowledge on the topic. But yeah, listen, if you've been enjoying the show, you can remember, you can find us on every single social media platform at That Money Show. Come check us out. Come DM us with your questions, because we want to answer them. So don't be afraid. You can also listen back on every single good podcasting platform, wherever you get your podcasts, we'll be there. And you can listen live on FUBAR Radio as well. And that's all for this week. I am That Money Guy. This is That Money Show. And hopefully together, every single week, these little hours that we spend together can help you level up your personal finances just a little bit.